Support for the AIPT Comics podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. They obsess over the technology development to provide you the best tools for your grooming experience. And because they support this show, if you use code AIPT20 on manscaped.com, you'll get free shipping and 20% off. But before you go there, let me tell you a story. When I was in college, the whole, what was that thing for us? The
metrosexual?
Yes. The whole metrosexual thing.
I can't believe I got that out of thin air. Wow. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. The trend.
Yeah, it was like in every magazine. And I remember thinking like, okay, so grooming yourself is important if you're a straight male, apparently, which I always knew, because why would you want to be gross? It blew up and then all these products came out. And I think that Manscaped came out of that and learned something, because honestly, I think they make a solid product. Having Manscaped myself prior to Manscaped ever existing, once this product came along, I really liked it. Like the light, the power, 7,000 RPM motor on these things. It's like, it feels really sturdy too in your hand. And you know, Forrest, because you've used yours
too. I've used everything that they sent us in a very lovely gift package. I do have to say that the underwear is so comfortable. And that was a nice benefit.
The deodorant,
It's nice. It's great. Smell. I like it.
But yeah, if you want to go get yourself a Lawnmower 3.0, go to manscaped.com and use AIPT20 when you're checking
out. With free shipping. 20% off and free shipping, manscaped.com, AIPT20.
Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 80. Oh my God, we're so close to 100. My name is David Brook. I am your co-host and I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how you doing?
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's. I'm doing okay. I had some dirty lettuce from a restaurant earlier, so we need to go fast.
Oh, geez Louise.
Things are proceeding at an unexpected rate.
Are you saying your intestines are lubricated?
Yes.
Well,
from the dirty vegetables, what were done to me. I ordered a Caesar salad.
Oh.
And you know when you bite into that romaine and it just tastes like nature's seasoning? That's not good for you.
It was gamey. Gamey lettuce.
Yeah. Yes.
This is the comic book news, review, and interview show. This week we don't have any guests, but we do have a special segment. We're going to be talking about a TKO book that we want to highlight. To start every show, we recap the biggest news in comics to keep you up to date and connected. And at the top of our show, Marvel Comics revealed their Comic-Con at home schedule. This is the SDCC 2020 replacement for the in-person convention, and it is their virtual convention, Comic-Con at home. And Marvel revealed, let's see here, how many were there? Three panels. Yeah. Now, one of them we already knew from Disney Plus revealing a few days ago that they would be having a Marvel's 616 panel, which we actually talked about last week, I think.
We did.
They are also going to have Marvel HQ and Marvel Comics Next Big Thing, the biggest panel, in my opinion, at every big convention, because Marvel is quite good at dropping some mega reveals at these panels.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that's specifically because they don't do it at other conventions. They do some news at like New York City Comic Con or C2E2 or even Emerald City, but it's usually smaller news. Like, hey, we're doing a series of one-shots around X-Men. It's nothing like what they do at the Next Big Thing, which includes like Tom Brevoort, Al Ewing, Dan Slott, Jordan White, Teeny Howard, Gary Dugan, Nick Lowe, Nick Spencer, Mark Bagley, and also Taboo.
Yes, Taboo.
From Taboo of the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah, the Black Eyed Peas, who has the Werewolf by Night coming out.
Yes, a lot of big news coming out of that. But they do a really good job of holding off throughout the year.
Yeah.
They really make SDCC feel like an event. And I think that their Comic-Con at home thing will succeed just because of that.
Yeah, and word is that pretty much every panel that's going to be at Comic-Con at home is pre-recorded. So that's going to be kind of cool, because now they can actually play around with like animations, good editing, maybe even like comedy that works.
Do you think that they will do that?
Probably, most likely.
I think all of the pre-recorded stuff will just be them editing out people rolling their eyes at Jimmy Cebulski.
Well, you know, when I saw Taboo's name, I was like, oh, there's no way that guy's going to come up into this live. Like, he's most definitely going to be like, he's going to be on the top of Everest.
Taboo is not a noted live performer.
No, come on.
He's all about those Black Eyed Peas vignettes.
Yeah, right.
It's going to be him on an elephant. It's going to be him in a nightclub, in a Ford Ferrari.
Yeah, he needs to come in with style, and that's why it needs to be pre-recorded. It's going to be directed by Steven Spielberg.
It's going to cut to Teeny being like, "Oh my God, let Taboo take that one." Taboo's like skydiving.
Marvel screwed up. They needed J.J. Abrams to direct this panel. Yeah. And he could have been like, "Guess what? The Spider-Man comic was all a lie. It's not real. It never really came out." I was just kidding.
We were just farming some IP.
They'll be talking about Amazing Spider-Man 850, which is coming out. It's going to be an anthology extra-sized issue. They're going to be talking about X of Swords, Ten of Swords, or whatever it's called. And then they're also going to be talking about Empire, which is obviously still going on.
I prefer Key of Swords.
Yes, that's right. I said that the other day. Yeah.
Or Cross. I was
like, that's good. Oh, it's worth noting Marvel HQ is for kiddos. So if you have kids, it's July 23rd, Thursday at 4 p.m. PST Pacific. And then the Marvel's next big thing is Friday at 11 a.m. PST. So perfect timing for that news rush at noon.
Speaking of for children, Marvel is also launching a line of OGNs with Scholastic.
Get out.
You know, from the book fairs.
Oh my God.
For middle graders.
My childhood, I see it.
That includes Miles Morales, Shockwaves. I think that there are some other stories, including Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan.
Yep.
And Shuri. So youthful characters aimed at the right audience, powered by Scholastic, in an OGN format. You could say that Marvel's doing something right this year.
Yeah, you know, we posted this news on Thursday at aptcomics.com, and the reaction, a lot of reaction, was like, holy shit, they're doing what DC Comics is doing so well. Maybe they're going to finally get into this market.
Yeah, I mean, the book market is incredibly successful. Even the graphic novel market, if you include things like Raina Talmeiter's books. I think I got her name wrong, but folks know what I mean. The DC Inc. line has also been super successful. That's like the Catwoman and Mara and other books that DC has been putting out. Those aren't marketed as single issues or as comics at all. They're for the book market. I mean, they're for, you know, Amazon or Scholastic or Barnes & Noble, whatever it may be. They're actually on book stands at like Walmart and stuff as well. That's where people want to be met with comics. That's definitely where people want to be able to get their kids comics. And they don't want to be like, wait, do I need to get a back issue for this? And they picked the perfect characters.
With Spider-Verse out, like kids, you know, they love that movie and they probably rewatch it all the time. Yeah.
And Ms. Marvel, her reboot was incredibly successful. And Shuri is also a great character. I'm sure most kids have seen Black Panther at this point.
Oh, yeah.
I also love how diverse it is, and that's creators and the characters. So I have nothing but good things to say about this.
Yeah.
I also really tend to enjoy, just from my own personal reading, light, fun stuff like this. I really liked the Spidey series that they put out previously.
Oh, yeah, it was really good. Todd Knock.
Yeah, Todd Knock did a lot of it. And then DC's Primer, which came out recently, that was ostensibly for kids, but I liked it a lot.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah. And they tend to take more risks, I think, with the art style. Like, they don't go for that hyper-realistic superhero stuff that most Marvel and DC books, mainline books, go for.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, they knocked it out of the park, and that's great, because right now we need good news. But... Take with me a time travel back to the past when Marvel was blowing everyone away with their Ultimate Universe and Robert Kirkman was still writing at Marvel Comics. Back on July 7th, Robert Kirkman was on the Comic Tropes YouTube show. They actually split this interview up into multiple pieces for good reason. He has a lot of tantalizing things to say. I happened to watch it this morning and I read a little bit of news on aptcomics.com that kind of pulls out the key quotes. But basically, he said he was treated like crap at Marvel Comics, and he thinks that they resented him because at the time he had Walking Dead and Invincible blowing up on the trade paperback charts.
Yeah, the direct quote is, "I'm making nickels and dimes from you assholes. I'm making crazy money at the same time from Invincible and Walking Dead. My collections are doing great, and I'm working for nickels over here at Marvel. I'm getting treated like crap and yelled at all the time for just trying to, like, put an extra level of care into the book. They resented the fact that I didn't need them." He also outlines at least one experience he had with Joe Quesada, where Quesada said, "Why don't you worry about the story before you worry about your X-Men royalties? who cares about where a book is collected and who's getting the royalties from that story? Why don't you just focus on the writing? What's wrong with you? And these are obviously from Kirkman's recollection. So sure. I don't want to put that out there as fact. That's his experience. Mm-hmm. It does not paint Marvel Brass in a good light.
Right. I mean, Quesada's still up there in the top brass. I don't think he's editor-in-chief anymore, right? No, that's C.B.
Cebulski.
But still, he is up there at the top. And, you know, even at Image Expo 2014, this is not necessarily new news. He said that Marvel was poorly run.
Yes. And he at that time, he was clear to make sure that it wasn't the people that he was working with, artists and colorists and letterers right. and stuff, but that it was actually the management. I mean, right. It seems to be the same problem here. I do have to say this doesn't surprise me at all, first of all. We talked last week about how you could infer that a lot of the pencils, downs, orders that came, I got some plurals wrong in there, that came along earlier in the pandemic were from Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
When Boom and DC and plenty of others were saying, we're still paying creators, you can kind of process of elimination that. As well as, you know, they have a history of hiring specifically artists from other countries and charging them or paying them lower rates,
mm-hmm.
lower rights, lower royalties. There are well-documented rumors about Marvel having extreme control over their IP, editorial decisions, as well as, you know, movie and comic video game rights and all that kind of stuff. It's not surprising in the slightest. It's obviously a habit they have. It's a corporate culture. I do also have to say, from Joe Quesada's perspective, if Kirkman were coming to me all the time being like, when am I going to get paid? And I inferred that it was interfering with his work.
Yeah.
I would be annoyed by that.
In his anecdote, he points out that the way Marvel was collecting Ultimate Line comics, they would kind of stuff a lot of their miniseries into like Ultimate Spider-Man or Ultimate X-Men to sell it.
Uh-huh.
And so he asked where the stories he was writing in this crossover event with Mark Millar and Brian Michael Bendis, where it would fall. And Kirkman insinuates that Quesada was like mad about that and assumed that he thought it was about royalties. But yeah, it's obviously only one side of the story. It was nice that he did just praise Tom Brevoort like over and over. He said he loves and adores the man. And in the same interview, he talked about another editor having a run-in with them. But it was because he was like on another title that he didn't actually say the title or the editor's name, but he was on another title that Tom Brevoort wasn't editing. So that was why that was kind of an issue. It's interesting that he's coming out and saying this so many years later, too. I mean, we're talking almost 20 years later, right?
Right. I mean, he probably feels some degree of freedom and financial stability at this point. Maybe he's not interested in Marvel properties anymore. Maybe he doesn't feel that he has any stories to tell there. Or maybe he's trying to nag them into getting a job.
I mean, he already did the Invincible Spider-Man crossover like 15 years ago or something. So.
Right. He may just be like, I don't need them.
Right. He actually even kind of says that in the interview. Maybe they took offense
to that even at the time.
He had a comment that was like, eh, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Right. And maybe they took offense to that even at the time if he was already being flippant about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't particularly like him. Mm-hmm. But also hearing all this stuff about Marvel does not surprise me in the slightest.
I recommend checking out the Comic Tropes YouTube channel and watching the interview. It's worth it. And there's more to that Kirkman interview too. He talks not mm-hmm. just about the Marvel Thomas.
He's a very interesting figure. He knows what he's talking about. He's editorially minded.
He says, of Image. I mean, how many writers can say they were a president of a publisher?
Yeah. He says good things. He has good insights.
I mean, the only other creator I can think of his stature, not that he's an artist, but like Jim Lee, he's actually managed and run a company like Kirkman has, mm-hmm. but also been on the ground, you know, busting out pages.
I think Kirkman is actually probably more financially successful than anyone in comics that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, he started Skybound Entertainment, which is having their 10-year anniversary this year.
Right. And to say nothing of how profitable Walking Dead alone is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Give me some of that Walking Dead money.
Yeah.
Speaking of money, Marvel is launching King in Black this December 2020. That's right, this December 2020. Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman on Friday afternoon posted a video on Marvel.com and Marvel's Twitter that basically had them explaining what King in Black is, that it's the Null story that has sprouted from Absolute Carnage because Null is now free and rushing to Earth to kill us all, I assume. Mm-hmm. Or maybe enslave us, who knows. I would recommend watching the whole interview. It's like 3 minutes, but there's a funny, I think it was clever. A funny little ending where they swear a lot. It's a simple joke, but I don't know. Coming from a Marvel, official Marvel account, I was a little surprised they went there. Are you excited for King in Black?
You know, I am. I hope that it is not treading water like I felt like Absolute Carnage kind of was.
Yeah.
It seems like the Venom story has been headed in this direction for a really long time. And I hope that this actually offers some finality to this chapter of Eddie and Venom's life, rather than being like, I fear a final page that's like one little bit of Null floating back out to space.
You know what I mean? Just like Absolute Carnage, kind of. Right. The symbiote's exactly. Still alive.
But if they deliver on all the things that they've been building to for what, like 2 years now?
Yeah.
I think it's time to capitalize on that stuff. And that could be very interesting. It could be very well done. They obviously have a very big story to tell, saying that this is going to involve like all the X-Men. I think it's going to be a publisher-wide event.
Yeah, definitely.
And if they're buying into it at that level, I'm interested. I think that Donny has big ideas. And if they do tie-ins that allow other artists to capitalize on those, it could be really, really cool. I know some people are tired of his 90s throwback, Hot Topic, kitschy type stuff, but as a doom metal goth baby at heart, I like it. It speaks to me. It's dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'll give it a shot.
Do you think it was always slated for December, or did it get pushed because of the pandemic?
I bet it got pushed. It screams summer event to me.
It's definitely, they don't usually put out events in December because, no. I mean, they actually reduce the amount of books. Yeah, I mean,
it actually seems more like an October type thing, September, October.
Right.
But because they aren't going to have any breathing room with Key of Swords and Empire.
Key of Swords, man.
They probably, that's a Kingdom Hearts joke for those that don't know.
Oh, I didn't know that. I have to say, it's interesting that they're launching this literally days before their actual big summer event starts.
Yeah, it does make me wonder what's going to be at their Comic-Con at home stuff.
I don't know. I feel like they should have held this at least until Empire Number 2 came out. It's a little early to be hyping this, but I guess it's a whole different thing than Empire is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, you know, as long as they don't,
as long as they don't wear it thin, you think this is only six issues, no tie-ins?
And probably like 20 tie-ins max, not
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, Absolute Carnage, the first issue had 17 variant covers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this stuff's obviously profitable for them.
I think it's funny that Spider-Man's so tiny on the issue one cover. It's almost like he's not a big deal. And it's like they're trying to say, look, Venom doesn't need Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Back off.
Or maybe Nick Spencer was like, I don't want to play with you.
Maybe. Hey, we actually interviewed Ryan Stegman on the show, two, 3 weeks ago now?
Yeah.
And is this his big...
This is definitely what he was alluding to.
He was alluding to some big project.
Venom fans were going to be very excited by it, and I am.
I'm a little shocked, actually. I didn't think it was coming this soon. I was assuming, like, spring, but... It's pretty cool. I'm excited to dip into it. Stegman, if Stegman's drawing it, we're in good hands.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, I was not very impressed by how Marvel handled themselves during the early stages of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But they are kind of back up to full speed,
They are, yeah, I think so.
And I'm pretty warm on the stuff that they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, Key of Swords looks cool. Empire looks cool. Though maybe a little outstretched, and this works for me as well, to say nothing of a Scholastic deal, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Speaking of deals, The Beat had news this week about the Marvel Digital First, or Digital Only, is what they were calling it at first, comic books like Ant-Man and Avengers of the Wasteland and Ghost Spider and Hawkeye Freefall are all actually going to be printed and sent to comic shops. This is great news for a lot. Surprise. I know a lot of people were very upset because when they said digital only, I think even, I'm not sure if they ever officially said, but I think like some higher ups made it sound like including like Matthew Rosenberg, who wrote Hawkeye Freefall, made it sound like it would be digital only and then it would be collected, so you could never actually own Hawkeye Freefall number 5. But they've obviously reversed this.
In single trade, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So out in August, it seems like they're just going to every week dump these books. If you hadn't got them digitally, you can now get them physical in the physical format, which is, I think it's cool. I mean, it seems like they're actually listening to fans, which is what they want, right?
Yeah, I'm sure Diamond is happy as well.
It's really all about Diamond, isn't it? Ah,
yeah.
I didn't think of that.
I don't think that they've ever successfully kept a digital-only comic truly digital-only. I think those Cloak and Dagger books, as well as the Jessica Jones books, were eventually printed, weren't they?
I think they were printed in trade, but I don't
in
think
trade.
They were.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you know, that they, sometimes they market this as like a new format, a new story and stuff, and they always revert to having them physical. So it's neither here nor there, I feel.
Yeah. Other good news, E-Viewing and Simone DeMeo's Champions is back on the schedule, according to The Beat.
E-Viewing can do no wrong. Put it in my veins.
Eve is quite good. So yeah, there was a while there where everyone was very upset that the whole Outlawed thing wasn't happening, especially since it's kind of referred to here and there if you've been reading closely to Marvel Comics coming out. But yeah, it is coming. It's just got delayed because of the pandemic. So yay, more
comics.
Yeah,
that's cool.
But oh no, no more conventions. Dragon Con was canceled officially this week. No surprise from us, I'm sure. It seems like we say this every couple of weeks. There's another big con that is canceled. Although New York Comic Con yet to be canceled. And that's only in October.
That's got to be an insurance thing.
Could be.
It has to be.
So if you plan on going to Dragon Con, I'm so sorry, but it's not happening.
It's also for the best. Wear your mask. Stay home.
Indeed. What is
happening? Wear your mask at home.
Image Comics was selling Humble Bundles for quite cheap and generated $140,000 plus to benefit the Bink Foundation, which helps comic shops and their employees who have been struck by the pandemic and obviously are in financial dire straits. Actually, if you go to pprecipients.com, you can actually see who got what and how much.
Cool.
So it's kind of neat. Yeah, so...
Yeah.
More good news.
I can't think of a time, actually, if I'm thinking about it, that a comics Humble Bundle hasn't been successful.
I know.
The Walking Dead one did super well. The Lock and Key one did very well. IDW does some that do well, like licensed comics that they have the rights to. Mm-hmm. And now this, obviously this was even better performing than usual because people wanted to donate to the charity as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the Humble Bundle, folks. I get the games all the time.
It's a super good deal, right?
Yeah, it's a very good deal.
Yeah. Deal or no deal? You know, talking
deal,
about deals. Speaking of deals. Oh my God, this show writes itself. Boom Studios has signed 4 different artists to what they call superstar artists to mega deals, comic book cover deals. They signed Mirko Andolfo, Miguel Mercado, Peach Momoko, and today they reveal Jenny Frison. Most of these deals are for 20 covers. I think one of them was actually for just 12. I think that was Mirka. And it goes through 2021. It's an interesting marketing move, I think, because I bet you these kind of deals happen all the time. But Boom is not only lifting up the artists and sending out this news to press, but they're also pushing out the fact that there are variant covers for future titles. So it's like a win-win-win-win for everybody. And yet it's still kind of hilarious to me that they're making this big deal out of signing a deal.
You know why?
Why is it?
We actually didn't talk about this on the show, but there was a pretty big wave of complaints about how Boom treats artists and writers over the last couple of months on Twitter.
Oh yeah? When was this?
It was initiated by Kate Leth, and it was maybe 2 months ago. I want to say right before kind of some of the more speaking out Me Too things were happening.
Mm-hmm.
But people were saying, you know, Boom never paid me. Their editors avoided me at cons. Mm-hmm. They treated me poorly. They moved my deadlines around. They never released work that I did for them and said that they didn't have to pay me because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And these weren't all things Kate said. Quite a few people spoke out, actually, about how Boom had mistreated them. So this seems like a little bit of PR.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think that they're trying to correct course. I think that both of my favorite books this week are Boom books. I like the stuff that they put out.
Yeah.
But I do... Sometimes there's a moral dilemma with supporting them, given things that I've heard over the years.
I sent you a tweet from Declan Shalvey saying, like, wow, publishers are announcing cover deals now?
Yeah.
I want to announce that I'm drawing my own covers.
It was kind right, of which is to say, this is not the norm, and I think that they're overcorrecting.
Yeah, I feel like it's strange that they did it all four in one week. Like, they're really drawing attention to the campaign and less attention to the creators by doing that.
Right.
If they spread this out over, like, 3 weeks, it would make it so it was more about the artists so that we wouldn't, you know, see through their kind of marketing arm.
Right. It's very cool, transparent though. To me. It is cool.
I'm honestly Jenny excited. Yeah.
Jenny Frison's Wonder Woman covers that they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Well, I mean, I think it's awesome to just, I mean, a lot of these, I mean, people know who Marco Adolfo is, but they don't necessarily know her that well. And I mean, I didn't know who Miguel Mercado was before I saw the news.
Right.
I did know who Gary Larson was when he returned to the Far Side comics
this
week.
Yes.
Far Side is probably one of the greatest comic strips of all time. Comic strip?
Far Side got me into comics, yeah.
Yeah.
Hellboy got me into sequential storytelling. But I used to buy, or my mom used to buy me from Borders Books, collections of, like, newspaper comics. So I would get, like, Get Fuzzy and Far Side and several others. Like, usually for Christmas or my birthdays or whatever. And that's kind of really where I fell in love with comics. I think that, you know, Calvin and Hobbes is another big one for people. But I think Far Side is right up there in terms of, like, surrealist, simple humor, elegantly done. Larson is very funny. And he had fallen out of love with Far Side or with comics in general. He actually did an interview, I think with the New York Times. Let me make sure. Yeah, with the New York Times, where he had basically said, I hadn't done any new stuff except for Christmas cards for my family.
Mm-hmm.
For like 25 years. And one time I sat down to do the Christmas card, my pen was clogged. I had to throw my pen away, get everything cleaned up. And I thought, what if I just got one of those tablets, meaning a digital drawing tablet? It would at least make my Christmas card thing easier.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with making comics again.
Hmm.
So he had launched the Far Side website recently. I think we actually talked about this on the show. And they had been, it's kind of like a Gary Larson archive. They've been posting old strips and stuff like that over time. But he's now putting out new stuff on it because he has fallen in love with drawing comics again.
Yeah, three new comics. And they look very, like, they look painted. They look very pretty.
They look good, yeah.
Yeah, they're a little, like, upscaled from his usual stuff.
Yeah, I love Far Side. It's very near and dear to my heart. It's very nostalgic for me. I'm sure it is for a lot of people. I mean, again, we're talking about he hasn't released any in 25 years.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a little inspiring, a bit of an inspiring story where it's like, I sometimes get burnt out on talking about comics or wanting to review them or feeling like this thing that I love a whole lot, and I know you feel this way sometimes too, is burning me out or it feels like homework.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously felt that way for a long time, but allowing him to change the format kind of fell in love with it again. And I think that that's just an inspiring anecdote about inspiration and creativity.
Not to mention, you know, he's an older man and he's coming back.
Yeah, totally.
You know? That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very happy for him.
Next up in news, DC Comics announced two new horror anthologies coming out for October, which I'm psyched for. DC's really good at these anthologies, and they typically do one Halloween horror anthology, but this year they're doing two. One's called mm-hmm. Legend of the Swamp Thing, and the other is DC The Doomed and the Damned.
Mm-hmm.
So an insane amount of talent on both of these.
Yeah, they've got some of the Hill House folks on here as well. Carmen Maria Machado,
yeah.
Who did the Lolo Woods for Hill House, is on The Doomed and the Damned. You've got folks like Tom King, James Tynion IV, the fourth, James Tynion IV. I'm never ever sure.
The sequel.
Vita Ayala, Ram V, Mike Perkins, Emma Rios, Christian Ward, John Arcudi, Saladin Ahmed across these books. Riley Rossmo is one of my favorite artists of all time. Can we talk about Man-Bat's muscles?
Yeah, so they released some cover art here by Kyle Hotz, and they are bubbly. They are bubbly muscles.
He's got muscles on his muscles.
Go to aptcomics.com. You can check it out. He's actually like, and he's like foaming at the mouth. No, he's like
muscles
spitting
all the way down.
Someone just sprayed water
also
in his mouth, and he's really
uncomfortable. Also, the Crypt Keeper is
there. Yeah, that's really creepy in the background.
Why is
Batman's
his,
very...
Why does his muscles look like that, though?
Look at the muscle in Batman's neck. I think he's hiding a penis there.
Why do...
Is there a penis?
Wonder Woman looks very berserk.
Wonder Woman is wicked ripped. Like,
yeah.
Dude, drink some water. You are dehydrated, man.
The Swamp Thing cover alludes to, like, the Council of the Green. You've got, like, all the previous Swamp Things here. That's very cool. And
very
potentially
cool.
Very scary. They're very... surreal, scary.
Oh yeah,
John Carpenter shit.
Oh yeah, that I'm excited for. I will read and buy both of those.
Probably more accurately, Alan Moore type shit.
But yes, like we talked about on the
same
show. Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
that pulpy like horror. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
In our last bit of news, comic and graphic novel sales reach 1.2 billion. Yes, with a B, dollars.
Yeah.
In 2019. Say what?
Yeah, and this is almost exclusively because of the book market.
Yeah, so Comic-Con's John Jackson Miller and ICV2's Milton Gripp basically laid out the fact that sales are up 11 freaking percent this year, and that's with a pandemic.
People have free time, man. The retro game scene is also exploding. You know how fucking expensive it is to get a Game Boy Advance right now?
No idea.
Damn, it's not cheap.
What about
just
a
got
Sega
my
Genesis
wife one
Mini?
For her birthday.
Oh, really? Oh, shit.
The Genesis Mini is a good deal.
Did you just say what her birthday present was on the show?
Yeah.
But she doesn't listen.
But also, she watched me buy it.
Oh. Some gift giver you are. It's all about surprise, Forrest.
I want the things that I want.
That's true.
I don't believe in that shit.
I'm the worst person to buy gifts for because I buy literally everything I want.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think of it.
I'm also terrible. Yes, you're very difficult to buy gifts for. I had several things in my Amazon cart for you one time, and then you were like, I got these.
If I was in the Boy Scouts, I'd have a badge for it.
Done.
That's it for news. Oh my God, it was so positive and happy, and there wasn't that much negative stuff.
I feel good about all this stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like
hopeful.
Gary Larson right now.
Hell yeah. We're back, baby.
I'm back. Baby.
It felt like
25
years. The last 3 months, yeah.
I'm only 27 years old. That means I got burnout on this when I was 2.
Dang.
It was the lettuce what did it.
In our next segment, TKO Corner. This is where we're going to just highlight a TKO book that we've read recently. And TKO,
you talking
nice...
TKO to me?
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to knock you out, bro. TKO was nice enough to send us a few of their books.
Yes, very nice.
They come in different formats. You can get it in trade or in single issue. And they actually also gave us the opportunity to give you guys a 20% off deal. If you use AIPT20 in the discount field when you go to check out at the TKO website, you can actually get 20% off.
Which I believe that URL is TKO Presents. TKOPRESENTS.com AIPT20.
Yes.
20% off for these excellent comics.
Yeah, they're really good. So I wanted to highlight Pound for Pound, which is by Natalie Chaidez, Andy Ballinger, and Daniela Miwa. This book is a surprise and a delight because it's a surprise. So Pound for Pound is basically about, so it's a female protagonist who is a boxer working basically for gangsters to allow them to gamble and make money. It opens with the character. She's supposed to throw a fight, but she couldn't do it. Her parents died on the border of Mexico and America on their way back. They're on their way to America to basically become citizens and become free, right? And so it's an immigrant's tale, but it's also a boxing tale. But then midway through, shit goes down. It gets crazy in this book.
And like, how many issues is it? Is it six?
Six issues, yeah.
Six, okay.
Yeah, and so when you're reading it in trade format, there's actually, you get to see the cover. Basically, each issue is a chapter, and they actually say chapter one, chapter two, chapter three.
And that's because, for folks that don't know, TKO releases all of their series at once.
Yes,
meaning
that's right.
They release them in trade and these like oversized single issue boxes. So I think that that's probably easier from a writer's perspective to do acts or chapters.
Yeah, true.
There's nothing happening to them between the issues. They've got them all published and ready to go by the time TKO sends them out.
Yeah, so they basically get to write without the pressure of, oh my god, does the issue one sales look good?
Right, it's much easier to script an entire story.
And it's also really cool, like, if you like reading floppy single issues, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say, I was a huge fan of 100 Bullets, or at least a big chunk of 100 Bullets when it was coming out. I don't even know when. 2 decades ago now?
25 years ago.
And this book gives me 100 Bullets vibes. There's a lot of gritty, crime-like feeling scenes, even though it's like a fight comic, too, because the main character, Danny Libra, is an MMA fighter. You have a lot of seedy scenes in, like, back alley kind of areas and strange and violent scenes that are fantastical enough that it's almost unreal. And it actually gets really
right.
unreal
and
by the
so
end.
And so you don't feel that it is, like, too gritty or melancholic to read right now, right? I know some people have talked about, specifically around The Last of Us 2, not wanting to engage with really graphic or gory stories, but you didn't feel that was kind of encroaching on your enjoyment at all?
No, it took a little while for me to get into it, to be honest. It took a little while for me to, like, understand the vibe of the book. But it goes so far left, like a Garth Ennis kind of style, like Preacher style, wild, violent, but in a almost cartoony sort of way. Not like it's Looney Tunes, but like, oh my god, I can't believe they did that. I don't want to spoil a single thing though, because I have to say, like,
hit me with some deets.
So it opens with this character screwing over this gangster, and they're going to kill her. She runs away. She tries to flee with her sister. They kidnap her sister. So they got to go after them. Her stepdad and her boyfriend go after them to save her sister. And soon she's, like, killing gangsters and stuff. But, like, midway through, they, like, run into a meth cult in the middle of the desert on the Mexico-America border. And they, like, are not the craziest people in the desert, apparently. And they have their own, like, rules of law. And there's some interesting father-daughter dynamics going on in the story, too. But at the same time, like, the father trained the main character to be a fighter. So there's a lot of elements that are kind of working together, but those wacky, wild elements are the ones where you go, this is a fucking comic and it's fun. And the very end, it's just, it blows my mind what they did at the end. It's very end.
Did it feel like a complete story to you, having that chapter structure? Did you feel, like, satisfied by the end of it? Or do you think that there's going to be a pound for pounds? Pounds for pounds.
Oh, God, I hope they don't go with that title. I thought that...
Just
look,
workshopping it.
Dude, whatever.
Sorry, I was really thrown by getting an email for gamerdatingonline.com, which I'm assuming is a website for gamers to date other gamers.
Oh my god, that's
one
of those for everything.
I was hot off that when I came up with pounds for pounds.
I don't think so. It's very much like a concise, action-packed, Lethal Weapon style. You get it all in one go, but you don't need another Lethal Weapon, I guess.
Yeah.
Because honestly,
Die Hard.
You know, like, if you read The Odyssey, do you think the main character, like, encountered all those insane things again? No, he only encountered all the wacky alien, you know, not aliens, gods, and, like, going to, like, Hades and shit. Like, that only happened to him one time, and that's what this adventure is like, because, like, you're not going to run into a meth cult every day, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Also, it's got, like, Breaking Bad. Okay.
You feel like, actually, I saw Mateus Bergara, the artist of Coda, say this the other day.
Yeah.
He said that the best advice that he ever got creatively was that comics panels are not boxes to fill.
Yeah.
They're windows into another world.
Mm-hmm.
And that you need to make sure you're looking through the window at the interesting times or parts.
Oh, yeah, that's what this is. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. This is like if Sylvester Stallone produced Breaking Bad, written by Garth Ennis, with art by Eduardo Risso.
Okay.
Period. So if any of those things checked a box for you, I think you should check it out.
Yeah, I will check it out. And next week, I'm going to talk about Sentient by Jeff Lemire.
That
I'm very excited
to
talk about that. I'm very excited by the stuff TKO sent us. And thank you to them. They actually didn't force us to advertise for them at all, but TKOpresents.com, AIPT20.
Yes, indeed. They just asked if we would. In our next segment, which we have every week, our top books of the week, our top two favorite comics out this week. Brand new, single issues, from a publisher, in your hands, Forrest, what's your second favorite book of the week?
My second favorite book of the week is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Willow number one. This is a new standalone Willow series from Boom's relaunch of the Buffy the Vampire title. This one is written by Mariko Tamaki with art by Natasha Bustos. It follows some of the stuff that has happened in the mainline Buffy comic, and then also kind of the crossovers they've had with Angel and Spike and other series. But I don't think that you need to read those prior to getting into this. It does a pretty good job of telling you what happened. If you couldn't infer from familiarity with the Buffy series, though, Willow's basically running away after their battle, their initial battle. I'm assuming there are going to be more with the Hellmouth in Sunnydale. For folks that are familiar with Buffy, this is kind of following parallel to the TV show's continuity, but they're their own takes on the characters. Willow doesn't, you know, look like Allison Hannigan or anything in this comic. Mm-hmm. It's very well done. It's a kind of a coming of age story. Willow is a little bit afraid to engage with her powers, and I'm assuming that that's being born out of this conflict that they had. The issue is centered around her trying to write this letter to Buffy or Giles or Xander or anyone that will listen, basically. And she kind of starts and stops it throughout the issue. And it's very much a just, we are setting up where Willow is. She's run away from home. She's nervous about reaching out to people. She's looking inward instead. And one part that really got me was that she, close to the beginning of the issue, she runs away to England just because, you know, she's kind of spinning her wheels. And she says, I guess a part of me thought of England as Mary Poppins and Agatha Christie, who in my early lesbian fan fiction made a killer couple. I thought that was really funny, like queer jokey storytelling from Mariko Tamaki. And then it's immediately followed by, I didn't think I would go all the way around the world just to feel as crap as I did at home.
Where is she typically?
She's normally in Sunnydale in the States.
What state is that?
I don't know.
Oh,
I'm sure someone knows. It's like California.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But I thought it was very funny. It's got this nice pulpy teen energy to it, but Mariko is very good at writing characters down moments too. You know, Laura Dean Keeps Breaking Up With Me has a lot of that storytelling. The art is a little simplistic, I found. But I actually thought that it kind of helped, because when they want to call attention to fantastical elements, like a woman who is placing a little bit of magic on Willow towards the end of the issue, they're able to do so. It stands out, you know, rather than like, this book is off the rails all the time. It's about magic. It's about Willow. It's about Buffy. it feels much more homegrown than that, and a little bit more earnest and a little bit more subtle. Both in the narrative and in the art. And I really appreciated it for that. I haven't been keeping up on the Buffy series, but this made me want to tune back into it. And I definitely do want to catch up before Zach Thompson tackles Spike and Angel later this year.
Nice. Yeah, they're building on it.
They're doing a great job. Like, I did not care about the Buffy, like, season 11 or season 10 comics that Josh Whedon originally oversaw. Also, fuck that dude.
Yeah, Dark Horse.
Those aren't very interesting, unfortunately. There is some good Dark Horse Buffy comics, but Boom has really kind of grabbed onto this and knocked it out of the park.
I really loved Bustos' work on Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. The comedic timing in that book is mostly, I think, due to Bustos' art.
Yeah.
My second favorite book of the week is Justice League number 48 by Cy Spurrier and Aaron Lopresti. Cy Spurrier is doing a 3-issue arc, which will be finished in Justice League number 50, which will also be an extra-sized issue. It's good sci-fi. Surprise, surprise, Cy Spurrier has great ideas and knows how to deliver them. This is also a good team book. So if you like superhero team books, you're going to get what you want, which is like every character has a role, every character has a say, and there's a moment for all them all to shine. But more importantly, Wonder Woman and Superman kind of come to blows. They don't agree on a decision that Superman makes, and the decision actually gets them in hot water by the end of the issue. And it's a cliffhanger that is clever, and it capitalizes on the idea of, if the Justice League are zipping around the universe saving other planets or people, wouldn't that get them in trouble with different cultures that may not see the universe like we do, or mm-hmm. may have different moral or, you know, choices to make every day. So that's introduced pretty well with the introduction of each alien that lives on this planet. And there's actually a third alien that shows up at the end, and yada, yada, yada. Lopresti's art is really well done. It's a good superhero style art. It's detailed and it gets the job done. And he's really good at the facial expressions, which I find if you've got a writer who knows how to write good dialogue, that's key. So if you like good sci-fi, I think you're going to like this Justice League issue, like Star Trek, say. It's almost like Star Trek with Justice League, because they show up to a planet, there's a problem, they try to solve it. Oh no, we have to go to commercial. And that's how it ends. I kind of want to spoil it, but I won't. The ending is definitely an interesting position for the Justice League to be in that I have never seen before. So yeah, check it out. Forrest, what's your favorite comic of the week?
My favorite comic of the week is Alienated number 4. This is written by Cy Spurrier with art by Chris Wildgoose. This also came out from Boom. You and I have been pretty hot on this series. It's been some kind of fun, heartfelt sci-fi storytelling. This issue takes that in a totally different direction. It has been exploring the central cast of characters and how they've been alienated by their families or by their own experiences or by society or by their school. This one follows Samir, one of the three main characters, and it follows kind of his experiences with self-harm, with emotional abuse, familial guilt, and fallout. It's got a very interesting sci-fi bend on those things, and that these kids have been empowered by this alien in their lives chip to take out their feelings on people that have wronged them in various ways. This one is exploring how someone resolves hurting themselves, and I mean that very literally. There's cutting in this. It's pretty graphic.
Yeah, it caught me by surprise, honestly. I wasn't expecting it.
But it doesn't feel like it is done for shock value in the slightest. It feels like someone trying to explore why they feel guilty, how they've been hurting themselves, and how they can resolve that, and how there are unhealthy ways of resolving those issues, especially when you have an alien that allows you to warp people to other places under your control. Mm-hmm. The story is barreling forward in a very, very satisfactory, difficult, earnest way. I was very impressed by it. I cried at the end of this issue. It was very difficult to read. I did want to call out that, like I said, it's graphic, and the warning for, or the disclaimer about calling the National Suicide Hotline is at the end of the issue.
Yeah.
I don't feel that that's Cy or Chris's fault. I would probably lay that on Boom's feet.
Oh, you think it should be at the beginning?
It should be on the cover and in the beginning.
I'm with you on that. I was feeling the same way. Yeah.
And because it is a graphic depiction of both the emotional trauma that people go through to get to that place, as well as it is rendered in the art.
Yep.
But it was a very, very impacting story. It felt deserved. It didn't feel cheap. It felt very empathetic to all of the characters at hand here. I feel better for having read it. I cannot believe that they're going to find a way to wrap this story up in only two more issues.
Yeah.
But I'm on board.
Yeah, this is the kind of comic where you're like, wow, comics can do even more, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a part in this where they go full, like, 70s acid trip horror.
Oh my god, Wild Goose nails it on those scenes,
too. And, like, yeah, you have this guy's dad kind of dissolving into a mandala of pain. Like, he's screaming, and, like, there's multiple variations of his face going down this acid-washed tunnel.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, weird and scary and surreal, but also totally relevant to what the narrative is touching on.
Mm-hmm.
Very well done. Very difficult to read, but the kind of difficult that I feel better for engaging with.
I was surprised, because, like, I thought Samir was, like, pretty well adjusted. He was like the one that seemed well adjusted, which I think is why it's such a beautiful,
yes.
Well, not beautiful, but a powerful story, because you realize, like, you know, most teenagers, probably all teenagers, are dealing with something.
Right, yeah. And Samir was kind of hiding that. This explores that very well. I think it also explores how people don't recognize that a circle of self-hatred, self-hurt, self-guilt isn't only internal, that it ripples out to other people in your life.
Right, right.
And they're doing so quite literally because all the characters are telepathically communicating and experiencing Samir's hurt. But also, it's, you know, it's speaking of a similar issue in real life.
Right, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's an impactful story. I do agree. I think there should have been some sort of warning or heads up.
Yeah, I don't want to put that on the creatives. But sure. I definitely do think that it should have been there. I think that when this series is done, I'll probably write an essay or something about it. It's been very interesting and very worthwhile.
Yeah, it's I mean, I would love to have been a teenager and read that then. Like, like now, you know, in my 30s, like looking back, I can reflect and kind of relate to it. But I wonder as a teenager what it would be like. It would probably be an interesting experience.
Right.
Well, you know, my favorite comment of the week is probably the exact opposite.
This one had a Baby Yoda reference.
It did. It did. It was a very simple. I don't know why people were gravitating towards that, because it's literally like 5 words in like a pretty dense and long 30-page comic. I think it was 30 or 31 pages. I picked Empire. I don't know. Okay, first of all, I do not like the numbering of these, but Empire number 0: Fantastic Four.
Yeah, so I don't understand why they're not just Alpha and Omega issues.
But yeah, or why didn't they just
Marvel
put
Comics events, baby?
Yeah, it's strange. Well, okay, so I reviewed this for aptcomics.com. So if you go over there, I have like a 1,000-word review on it, which will probably be a lot more articulate than I am right now in the moment. But I gave it a 10 out of 10, and I know a lot of people out there didn't like it, but whatever. I liked it because I had so much fun with it. It did 3 things for me really well. I liked the pop culture references, because there isn't just the Baby Yoda reference. There's other references as well to deep sci-fi storytelling and some other ones as well. There's a Baby Yoda one, though. My other reason for loving it was it just stands alone. It's a fun little adventure the Fantastic Four go on. And then the third reason is because it adds to the Marvel Universe and also Empire. It adds 2 elements to the Fantastic Four that they're going to literally bring straight into the Empire number 1 issue out next week, into the war, which will change the dynamics of not only the team, but how they interact with Kree and Skrull. And then also there is an introduction of a new character who I think was, off the top of my head, I think it was the sister of the Collector, who's introduced on the very first page. You're not supposed to know that. That's kind of a spoiler. I just gave it that way. It's like midway through you learn. But she is, instead of collecting things, she's the runner of a space casino. And I thought it was fascinating. This issue opens with, well, no, it doesn't open there, but midway through when we open on the Fantastic Four, we learn that the space monetary system has crashed and crumbled. And it's due to this character. And it's fascinating to me that they're introducing this idea of like space currency and it crashing and affecting all these different planets, which may or may not be a factor in the Empire story. But it creates this bigger sense of universe that you don't typically see in Marvel Comics. And I thought that was interesting. I'm a sucker for banking in any fiction. I really love Dagger and the Coin, the fantasy series too, which gets into that, but that's neither here nor there. Also, the art by Sean Isaacs and R.B. Silva, insanely good. They're 2 of the best comic artists in the industry, I'd say. And they split duties between pretty well. You can't really tell the difference. Isaacs is really good at drawing those big, epic, blockbustery moments. And R.B. Silver is dealing with a lot of the quieter kind of moments with the family, the Fantastic Four family. And obviously, Dan Slott wrote this book. So
I hear that is obvious from numerous sources.
You know, we mentioned this earlier about, you know, did Ryan Stegman mention something in the news? Reading this book, I was thinking back to when Dan Slott was on the show back in December, and I was like, he kind of wanted to tell us some things. I wonder if, and I mean, a couple of them probably had to do with Empire.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, if you listen to one of these shows from 6 months ago, Forrest and I were both like, ugh, Empire, ugh.
Yeah, it sounds like you're bought in.
I think we both are, right? Because last week you were saying you were interested.
I mean, I'm interested. I'm feeling more bought in on Death Metal, actually.
Really?
But I did kind of feel the same way about both of them.
Yeah.
Empire doesn't have its hooks in me just yet. I think when the more Al Ewing-y bits are relevant, it'll probably get me. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty excited for Death Metal next week.
You know, Marvel has sent us a lot of old collections, and over the last 2 years now, I keep reading these Avengers tales that I had never read or never fully read, and I think Empire is going to bring us some classic-y Avengers vibes we haven't gotten in a while, likely due to the movies kind of making it more pop fun, quick storytelling mm-hmm. rather than yeah. deeper kind of tales. So I'm pretty pumped for that aspect. But this issue blew me away.
Huh. I will check it out.
I honestly, if you read it and you hate it, I want to talk about it because I want to hear why. Because maybe I just didn't okay. get it. I did.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we talk about our number one favorite book out next week. We both picked Marvel. We are such Marvel homers.
I was just saying, I'm hot on what they're doing.
What did you pick?
A Giant Size X-Men Magneto number one, written by Jonathan Hickman with art by Ramon K. Perez. I like X-Men. I like where they're going with Key of Cross of Swords. I like Jonathan Hickman. I really like Magneto. Magneto was right. I think that they wouldn't be centering such an important figure if they didn't have a very good story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I have found over the last couple of issues, we have like a dozen issues for most of the Dawn of Swords, the Dawn of X books.
Sorry, say that again?
We're at like a dozen issues for most of the Dawn of X books, right? Yeah. Or not just the crossover event, but the X-Force and stuff. They're getting up in the tens now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have found myself really enjoying Hickman's take on Magneto.
Mm.
I'm looking forward to Magneto kind of getting his time to shine in this new universe and narrative direction.
Nice. Yeah. I really love the idea of this giant size series because it's about featuring the artists too.
Yes. Yeah.
And I believe that they obviously do it in the Marvel way. So Ramon K. Perez gets to like really just go nuts, go ham on the issue.
Mm-hmm. And for people that don't know what that means, have we ever talked about what the Marvel style is?
I thought you meant going ham. What going ham?
Oh, no. Have you ever talked about
probably
that?
Not. Probably not.
So the Marvel style, just for anyone that doesn't know at this point, if you've listened to 80 episodes of our comics podcast, you probably do. But it means that an author only writes the script out or like the major plot beats out and the dialogue. They don't do what a lot of other comics authors do, which is like time of day, page one, panel one, panel two, panel three, panel four,
right.
You know, we're writing a 9-panel grid panel by panel by panel with extraneous details.
Usually they don't even put the dialogue yet.
Do they not? Later. Yeah.
At least Stan Lee.
So Stan Lee does Jack it Kirby. In kind of that referential way.
This style is why Jack Kirby is way more impressive than you probably think, because Stan Lee would just be like, okay, now Hulk jumps here and fights the tank and right. then goes there.
Yeah.
And Kirby like literally put the story into the book.
And this is also why Ryan Segment was saying that he's been enjoying drawing Venom so much, because Donny Cates writes in the Marvel style, which is to say that the artist gets to take the major plot beats and motions and turn them into their own interpretation of that.
Mm-hmm. Always a good thing, I think. I think people don't give artists enough credit, and obviously the Marvel style kind of gives them more mm-hmm. onus.
Yeah, especially an oversized giant issue like this with a character that is central to Marvel's most successful, biggest comic line right now.
Which includes my favorite, or most anticipated book out next week, Spider-Woman number 2. Wait. That isn't necessarily tied to the most biggest line.
I don't think she's an X-Men. Yeah, but I might be wrong.
Maybe she's a mutant, who knows? This is written by Carla Pacheco and drawn by Perry Perez. I loved the first issue, and as you might have known, pre-pandemic, it was the number one book of the month. It sold the most copies.
Right.
For a good reason, I think. Carla Pacheco has a really good handle on the voice of the character. It has an edginess to it, a speed to it. It's almost like the character is on speed, in a sense, because she's like quick-witted, quick-fast with her quips. And it's funny, and it just looks really good, like a really clean book. And I don't know if you could tell from my number one pick of the week, but I want escapism right now. I want fun. I want out, you know, balls to the wall. Let's go crazy. Let's have fun. I mean, I'm still going to be reading all the darker brooding tales, but this book just screams to me like bright light, and I want that in my mm-hmm. life.
Yeah. I would also like to think that this podcast had a slight influence on that book.
Oh, yeah, Carla was on the show.
Well, then, and Carla specifically said that Night Nurse's catchphrase, you don't have an appointment, came from us talking about it.
Yeah, she tweeted to us, what, last week?
Yes.
When she was on the show, we I think one of us asked about the catchphrase. And
how, I did, yeah.
And she was like, oh.
I just think it's such a funny utilitarian line to be it's used great. In a silly way. And Carla's very good at that.
For sure. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we pick our favorite cover art out next week. I pick Dark Knight's Death Metal number 2 by Doug Mankey. It's one of the variants. And this cover is not on my screen. God damn it. I lost the window. Hold on. We're doing so good there. I don't have to do any editing, I don't think. Okay, yeah. So this cover is absolutely insane. Wonder Woman is holding one of those crazy multi-string, like many-stringed guitars. And it's got Batman Who Laughs skull on the end of it. And she's like also holding her Lasso of Truth chainsaw at the same time. So I'm not sure how she's playing the guitar. But it is an insane cover. She's also got this crazy eyeshadow. It's clear that she's like a heavy metal rocker. And on top of all of that, her lasso is actually doing like those... the bumps in the sound waves, as if her strumming this insane equipment is actually making noise and music in the air. Meanwhile, there are a legion of dead, undead zombies rushing towards her, literally like an entire stadium of them running towards her. And she's just freaking jamming on this. It's got to have a name. It's like a guitar? I don't know.
A guitar.
But it's just badass, honestly, and she's rendered well. I'm Doug Mankey, good lord. Yeah. You know, I've been reviewing a lot of DC lately. The dude is drawing books, doing covers like everywhere. Like, I don't know how this guy has time. He's like Alex Ross. But yeah, so that's just my take. What do you think? What is your favorite cover art of the week?
Mine is Amazing Spider-Man number 44. This cover art is by Carlos E. Gomez. I gotta say that I have no interest in reading Nick Spencer's Spider-Man anymore. I'm kind of burnt out on it, to be honest. But Kindred looks cool.
Mm.
Like, it's a good villain.
Mm.
And this cover features Spider-Man kind of drowning, almost like quicksand style, in a bunch of Kindred centipedes. It's got some great contrast between Spider-Man's colors and the centipede's colors. All this kind of mute brown choking out his bright blues and reds, and his white eyes squinting, looking up towards the title. It's very dynamic and foreboding. I like it. It's cool. It's also got a nice subtle gradient from purple down to the black at the bottom.
I like the shine in the eye, and I like his curdled hands. Curdled?
Yeah.
Curled totally. Hands? Curled fingers? Really well done.
Curdled like milk.
I have a friend who's an artist and a he's trying to do comics, and I tell you, hands are hard. So I hear. They're hard to draw, I mean.
I just let that play. Yep.
I'm all alone in here by myself.
I didn't know what you wanted me to say about this statement. Hands
in
are hard.
In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, this is where we talk about things unrelated to comics because we know you're sick of it. About an hour into the show, this week, Dave, that's me, gets to talk about something he's into right now, and it's Marvel Legends Hasbro's action figure line that is probably the best action figure line out there for the money, because they're so dang cheap. They're only like 20 bucks. You can get them for like 12 resale.
Yeah, get them on eBay. Get them out of the packaging.
Hell yeah.
Man, $8.99.
Although, if you go to AVGComics.com and on Friday, they revealed a new Sentinel action figure. Yes, a Sentinel that's 26 inches tall and will run you $350. They have to sell 6,000 of them in order to actually put them in circulation and build them. I'm sure they'll probably get there, although that's a steep price for most. Anyway, I've been collecting Beast action figures lately. I already have a humongous collection of Spider-Man action figures. And they don't come out fast enough for me to buy them, unfortunately. So I have slowly dipped into the Beast game, which is probably a safe bet that I won't have to buy 400 Beasts because, God, I don't think we need that many of them. Although I have the Blue Beast, the Gray Beast, who has glasses and a science book, and Dark Beast from
Age of Apocalypse.
Age of Apocalypse, the Onslaught stuff. Yeah. So I highly recommend these figures. Actually, I posted a bunch of these pictures on Facebook, and I had a couple friends reach out to me from high school, and they were like, holy crap, like, action figures have advanced. And it made me realize, like, you know, people like Forrest and I, who are, like, you know, reading the nerd news every day, we see all the developments as they're happening. But if someone who just, like, woke up from a coma, a 25-year coma, and they were like, where's my G.I. Joe? We go, no, here's a Marvel Legends. And they go, oh, my God, this is so good. So not only the paint job, not only the articulation in the face, but how the figures can pose, it's insane.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Golden age. You know, you have other people in the industry like Mezco that are doing Premier action figures, Hot Toys, those kinds of things. But Marvel Legends, like you said, very good bang for your buck. And they're actually getting better all the time. They're moving away from the pin style of assembling joints now. Mm-hmm. So you won't have discolored or very obvious pins on the outside of the figures. I think the first one of those is going to be Wolverine. But I have pretty much every symbiote they've ever released.
Yeah, I also love have a symbiote much. Collection. Yeah, they're awesome. You know, I wonder, I'd love to see a documentary on how they do it. Because, like, how do they paint these so meticulously?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And there are parts sometimes, too, that have to be, like, painted elsewhere than added. Like, there must be humans putting these together as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know humans put together, like, the Gundam stuff, so probably.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's it for the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked it, please go to Apple, go to this podcast, and like, subscribe.
And also tell your review friends. Us.
And tell your friends, yeah.
Wear your
mask.
Back
next week. We may or may not have an interview. Wait, we may have an interview. We will have an interview.
Don't eat dirty lettuce. Bye, I love you.
Hang in.